Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death, back after our extended Christmas New Year break. But it's good to be recording some fresh episodes again. We hope you enjoyed those classic rewinds from the archive over the Christmas break. Today, we are talking about a brand new topic that we haven't really touched much on in this podcast yet, which is egg freezing. We'll go into a bit more detail about how that works if people aren't familiar with what egg freezing is. But we wanted to talk about it primarily because it's something which is becoming more and more common, particularly here in the UK and in much of the Western world. The numbers have almost doubled from 2019 to 2021. Still low numbers, but up approaching 5,000 cycles a year of women in the UK choosing to freeze their eggs. And before we go on to discuss this about the ethics, what's driving this, how we should feel as Christians, we wanted to stay up front. We're very aware that once again that we are two men talking about an issue which is particularly affects women, though not exclusively. And it's also something that's very sensitive. This conversation will touch on issues around infertility, parenthood, singleness. And it might well be a sensitive, painful topic for some people listening or for those you love. So just to say at the front, we're aware of that. We're trying to approach this as much as possible with sensitivity, with graciousness. We don't claim to have all the answers, and we wouldn't certainly want to be kind of patronizing and telling women what to do. We're trying to open a conversation. And as always, we'd be really interested to hear feedback and emails and comments from you guys, the listeners.
Yeah, it's it's something we've talked about before, but I think I'm painfully aware that the whole thing about infertility is still a deeply painful topic, which many Christian churches and Christian communities don't really engage with. I think they can be quite unintentionally incredibly insensitive to both to single people who would desperately long to have a child and to married couples who've been trying to have a child unsuccessfully for many years. And so, you know, I think there's absolutely no doubt that the reality that infertility is a kind of prolonged grief and pain, and not just for women, but for men as well. Many men long to have the experience of fatherhood. And, you know, again, we recognize, don't we, we're both of us in a very privileged position. We've got our own children who mean unbelievable amounts to us, and in my case, grandchildren. So this is a really sensitive topic, but it's fascinating to me because it's where kind of modern technology and biomedical science collides with human biology.
Hmm. And the reason I think we can't ignore it, not that people have been maybe, but I don't think you hear much about it in kind of church circles, is because it is exploding. I mean, the numbers are astonishing. You know, in 2013, there were 569 women who froze their eggs. That had shot up to 2,000 by 2018. So in just 5 years, it had increased by 240%. And that number is still going up. By 2021, it was up to 4,000. And I'm sure 2 years on, it's probably well over 5,000 now. So these are obviously small numbers in comparison to the total number of women who have kind of natural conception each year in the UK. But it's clearly becoming, it's no longer an entirely kind of micro niche fringe issue, is it?
Not at all. And of course, worldwide, there are many other countries which are way ahead of the UK, quotes,
yes,
in terms of numbers. And interestingly, you know, there's been some publicity about big companies, particularly big tech companies and other high-profile financial services companies and so on, who have been providing or offering egg freezing to pay for the cost of egg freezing for their female employees.
Yeah, and we're definitely going to come back to the kind of ethics of how we think through offering egg freezing as a kind of health benefit or perk a bit later on. But it's kind of unavoidable that this is becoming kind of increasingly mainstream. I mean, there was a story I stumbled across from a few years ago in the Daily Mail about how some fertility clinics have started advertising their services by kind of wine and cheese or Prosecco evenings, where they gather women, you know, in their 20s and 30s. And talk about, you know, have you frozen your eggs? Have you thought about it? Why haven't you frozen your eggs? And there's kind of discussions by the advertising regulator here in the UK about whether this is manipulative, whether this is irresponsible advertising. You know, increasingly you'll see influencers on Instagram and Facebook and other social media platforms talking quite openly about their own experience of egg freezing or recommending it. So there's kind of an increasing awareness among kind of policymakers and experts that this is a topic which is now kind of coming into the mainstream, and quote unquote ordinary women are being kind of confronted with this question: have you frozen your eggs? If not, why not? In a way that maybe they weren't even five years ago.
Absolutely. And of course, behind all this, there are huge commercial opportunities, quotes, pressures, because like the rest of fertility services, this is potentially a massive commercial positive, because the costs of going through egg sharing, and then there are annual costs for maintaining eggs in a frozen state. You know, potentially there's big money here, and so it becomes clouded, doesn't it? You've got these very complex mix of commercial, social, and personal emotional forces.
Yeah, I mean, the figures clearly vary from clinic to clinic, but a kind of rough rule of thumb I found online was that it can cost in the region of about £4,000 to £5,000 for the initial freezing, which includes all the kind of medication you need to take. But then there are annual storage costs. So if you keep your eggs for the full 10 years that the law currently permits, that could cost another £3,000 to £4,000. So these are not small sums of money, either for the person paying them or for the clinic reaping that in. Before we kind of delve into the ethics of this, it's probably worth us pausing and it's doing a quick kind of scientific refresher of what egg freezing is, how it works, why it came to be, for those who aren't kind of up to date on this. It all kind of came out of, obviously, IVF, which we talked about in this podcast before, the kind of the fact that you can now fertilize eggs with sperm outside the human body and then kind of reimplant them into the womb. But as far as I understand, egg freezing was first developed as an option for women who were undergoing chemotherapy, which might kind of render them unable to produce eggs. So before they started the chemotherapy, they were given the chance: do you want to freeze and save some eggs that could be reimplanted later? Is that right?
Yeah, Tim, I'm just sort of painfully reminded this is a sort of, daddy, where do babies come from? We're sort of recapitulating a conversation that we might
have to go back to the birds and the bees quite that far. I think people are familiar with the concept of a sperm and an egg, which have to be combined to turn into a human being.
Yeah, well, so what it turns out, and it really is quite mind-boggling, is that what is now understood is that in the female fetus, as early as about 10, 12 weeks of gestation, you know, when the it's just become a fetus from an embryo. Technically, you change from being an embryo to a fetus at 8 weeks. So at 12 weeks, you're a few millimeters in length. And yet within that female fetus, there are eggs. There are primitive ovaries. And those primitive ovaries are already creating eggs. So in other words, this little child to be is already at one level preparing to be a mother at 12 weeks of gestation. I mean, isn't that extraordinary? And some estimates are that by birth, you have 1 to 2 million eggs in the baby girl's ovaries, all sitting there. But then what happens is the numbers steadily drop. So by the time of puberty, they've dropped to a few hundred thousand. Again, I think these figures are all open to, you know, some scientific uncertainty and so on. They then, the number of eggs, so you have this massive oversupply, but every month it's dropping by several thousand, it seems. So at every monthly cycle, one egg is matured and is then lost in the normal menstrual cycle. But a lot of other, hundreds of other eggs, if not thousands of other eggs, then die at each menstrual cycle. And so therefore, the supply of eggs is steadily reducing as the woman goes through her life. Until by the time you get into the 40s, the so-called reserve, ovarian reserve, is pretty much exhausted. And certainly by the time you get to 45, pretty well, the large majority of women have all the eggs have died.
And so it's that kind of dwindling fertility over time that is driving what has kind of become known as social egg freezing. So egg freezing was initially offered for medical reasons for women who were about to become infertile effectively, or their supply of eggs was going to be destroyed through other medical treatment. But from 2000 in the UK and possibly earlier in the States and other parts of the world, it's also been offered privately as a for social reasons. So these are predominantly what women choosing it are choosing to freeze their eggs at some point in their 20s and 30s because they think they would like children in the future, but they are not ready or not able to have children right now. And so what they're doing is kind of making a gamble that actually by the time I'm ready or in the right circumstances or have the right partner or the right finances, whatever it is, I might be 40, 42, 38, at which point I'm aware that the chances of me conceiving naturally are low and dropping. But if I actually do IVF when I'm 42 using eggs that were donated in my 20s or 30, early 30s, I've significantly increased my capacity or my likelihood of having a child.
That's right. So this is the sort of ticking fertility time bomb, isn't it, that is often described, and which I know for some women is a sort of almost a terrible sort of reality that of every month, every year ticking by. So biologically, the peak time for fertility is actually around sort of early 20s. That's when the safest time, the most likely time to get pregnant, and also the safest biologically time for having babies. And that as you get older, and particularly, you know, beyond 30 and then beyond 35, both your chance of becoming pregnant are getting less, but also there are increasing risks to the mother, increasing risks to the baby. So if you, as you say, if you freeze a young egg, you increase, in theory, you increase, therefore, the chance of, you could then have IVF at a later age, probably with some hormonal support, or almost inevitably with some hormonal support, and then increase your chance of having a baby. And this is a real issue. I mean, as you said earlier, it's being discussed on by social influencers. There's a kind of, companies are offering it. Some companies are offering it. And you know, speaking personally and trying to protect confidentiality, but I've actually been approached by, on several different occasions, by single Christian women, young women that I know, who would like to talk privately about the ethics of all this and what do we think of this as a Christian. And it could be, for instance, that a relative is offering to pay for it, and then they're left in this kind of double bind. You know, am I being irresponsible by not going for egg freezing, or is this something that is really outside should I trust the Lord that if he wants me to have babies, he can provide them, much as in the scriptures.
Yeah. And, you know, talking about the kind of optimum age is being in the early 20s, in many parts of the world, and I think back in the past, that actually was also the time that most women chose to have children, or did have children. How much choice was involved is a different question. In some parts of the world, I think I saw in Afghanistan, the average age is still about 19, whereas, you know, in some of the richer, more developed countries, it's up in kind of 31, 32. And there's fascinating data that shows that actually the richer you are, even within a Western nation, the more, you know, the higher educated you are, if you have a college degree, the average age of first birth creeps up and up and up.
Yeah, that's right. And so I think there's some interesting data, isn't there, looking at maternal age at first birth in different counties across the USA.
That's right. Yeah, we'll put a link to this in the description. It's a really interesting piece of data research by the New York Times back a few years ago now in 2018. But they found that when they looked at, they broke down the data across the USA by county, and they found the counties with the oldest first-time mothers were number one, San Francisco County, California, and number two, Manhattan, New York, where the average age was close to 32 years old for women having their first child. So whereas in some of the poorer parts of the South, for example, lower educated, the average age of women coming forward for first birth is something like 21, 22. So a huge difference in terms of, you know, just think about how your life unfolds as a woman. If you start having a family at 21, or you start having a family at 31, and these are obviously averages, you know, so if the average in Manhattan is 31, that means there are an awful lot of women not starting families until they're 35, 38, 40. And I think it's fascinating to see how this disparity has grown. I mean, obviously there's lots of other social factors going on, and, you know, availability of abortion and birth control, and that varies dramatically from state to state, as we know in the US. But I think it's fascinating to see how you can see this trend between kind of less developed or more developed countries, but also even within kind of rich first world countries, as it were, there is this huge disparity in terms of women from different social classes when they start having families. And I can understand, like, it's not, you don't have to be a genius to figure out what's going on, right? More women in places like San Francisco or Manhattan are going to be working in high powered kind of white collar professional careers, whereby taking 5, 6, 7 years out, or kind of dropping down to part time, is going to significantly impede them kind of progressing in their career. It's going to take them out of the workplace at a time when their male kind of competitors are surging ahead and getting promotions. And just fundamentally, in the kind of social context of these kind of liberal, metropolitan, coastal, blue state kind of Democrat enclaves, when you're in your mid-20s or even mid-30s, a lot of women aren't kind of socialized or encouraged to think about starting a family. That seems like something you do down the line when you're settled and married, but, you know, the average 32 year old in San Francisco County is probably still, you know, living her life, enjoying her freedoms, you know, may well not have found a kind of long-term life partner, let alone got married. And so even aside from the kind of employment pressures, it's just socially and culturally not the kind of environment that is conducive to saying, do you know what, I'm going to have a child.
Yeah, absolutely. And just as a side issue, but I do think it's a really important point. I think this is a key factor in the whole abortion debate, because all the evidence is that many, many women in our societies across the world increasingly want to have regular sexual intercourse from 16 to 18 years onwards. And yet, you know, being sexually active is part of a normal activity, and yet they don't want to have a baby until they're in their 30s. And so, but you therefore have, you know, 12, 14, 15 years when people want to be sexually active, but they don't want to have a child. And this is why public health planners say we have to have liberal abortion availability simply because those are the choices, quotes, those are the lifestyle choices that people are making. So this has all kinds of knock-on effects. And yet, again, we don't want to, you know, there's a kind of right-wing conservative response. Well, of course, you know, this is all because, you know, to put it crudely, women have come out of the kitchen and the nursery and had started doing man's work. And if they only went back into the kitchens and got on with their biological functions, everything would be fine.
Yeah. And, you know, as you say, that this issue of kind of maternal age has kind of become a minor current in the kind of culture war, especially in the US, but I think everywhere across the Western world, in which kind of right-wing voices are saying, you know, this is a devastating consequence of feminism and the kind of social revolutions we saw in the second half of the 20th century. It's completely upended the social order. What I find fascinating is part of this story, the New York Times went and kind of spoke to obstetricians in places like San Francisco, you know, quote, it feels like no one here has babies under 35 anymore. But they also went and found obstetricians in Star County Hospital in Rio Grande City, Texas, where the average age of first birth is 22. And the obstetrician there says very few of her pregnant patients were married, and she can count on two hands the number of pregnancies that were planned. However, most can't afford birth control and there is no abortion provider nearby. And so when you look at the kind of heartland of these, of the kind of right wing place, I'm not really seeing much evidence of the kind of traditional Christian family ethic here. Yes, women are having children at the quote unquote right age, but why? It's not because they are, you know, dutiful housewives who've settled down with their husbands and are kind of raising children in that 1950s paradigm. It's because they can't afford birth control and abortion is culturally and socially unacceptable and there are no providers within driving distance. But none of these people are actually living the kind of quote unquote 1950s idealized lifestyle that the kind of right wing populist arguments would say is the ideal and is what these kind of coastal liberal elites in Manhattan and San Francisco have rejected.
Yeah. So these are desperately complex issues, aren't they? So as so often in the kind of topics we talk about, you can see this sort of constellation of biological, scientific, technological, social, theological, philosophical, they all sort of merge. I mean, if we just go back to this question of egg freezing, you know, it's something I find myself very conflicted about because I could make arguments either way. I could make arguments to say this whole idea, the concept behind egg freezing is really a denial of the creation order, of the way that in his sovereign will God created humanity, our human biology, and that wisdom is to learn to live within the limits of the way that he's made us. You know, and I'm very drawn to those kind of arguments and the importance of creation order and so on. And yet, I can hear the other argument that says there are so many positive benefits of universal female education, of allowing, you know, all the positive, all the benefits to women, to society as a whole, of ensuring that women have tertiary education if they're capable, that they delay childbearing, and also that older mothers make better mothers. And therefore, isn't this some form of insurance? We say that it's perfectly, you know, reasonable to have fire insurance and we insure our homes and our cars against disasters. So what's the difference? You're insuring your fertility. You may not meet the right person until you're in your late 30s. Isn't this a wise and reasonable thing to do?
And I think, you know, to continue that, I agree with it, that I can see both sides of the argument. And the positive case, I think, can be put quite simply, which is that if we as Christians have made our peace with IVF, which I know some Christians haven't, but you know, and we've discussed there's a variety of views, but lots of Christians can, you know, think that it is an ethical thing to do for those who might be infertile, then what it would be so wrong with doing IVF with eggs that were, you know, harvested a decade ago as opposed to 2 months ago? Like, what is the significant ethical difference between using eggs that were harvested at a point when they're much more likely to have a higher success rate? And so, as you say, fundamentally, I don't, while we have clearly have a kind of biological peak window around, you say, around your early 20s, I don't think we need to feel constrained or that God thinks it's wrong for us to have kids after the age of 22. I mean, if that was the case, women would be infertile from the age of 23, but that clearly isn't the case. There's a kind of bell curve. Your fertility rises and it falls, but it doesn't drop off entirely. And speaking personally, you know, I think the point about kind of emotional maturity is key. You know, women may well be physically or biologically most kind of ready to begin parenting at 21. But I think most women would feel the same to me, which is that I was much readier at 31 than I was at 21 to become a dad. And in fact, you know, as I said before, we adopted. So this question isn't actually relevant to us in terms of biologically, but actually, my wife and I never considered, didn't at all feel ready to have children until we were in our late 20s, which is quite common for our kind of peer group and probably the consequence of a lot of socialization and cultural things. But actually, you know, we got married at 23, 24, but it took 5 or 6 years before we felt kind of emotionally and circumstantially and financially ready. And I think that's a really common story. And so it would feel inappropriate and frankly disingenuous for me to start telling women they need to stop and undo 60 years of kind of cultural socialization, whatever else, and start having kids at 21 again like God intended, because that's fundamentally not the kind of the way I've ordered my own life.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think, again, if you come back to a sort of basic biblical perspective on all this, this concept of living with wisdom, you know, that what living with wisdom is not having kind of mapped out some kind of ideal template of what a life should be like. It's making responsible decisions before God in what we do with our lives and our bodies and everything else, but at the same time recognizing that those decisions have consequences. So if we choose to delay fertility to your 30s, as you know, so many people do, and to be honest, I did too. I was 30 when I got married. I was 35 when the first baby was born. That has certain consequences. It has positive consequences. You'll have some more life wisdom, some more maturity, some more experience to offer as a parent. It has negative consequences. You get tired. You're in the middle of peak professional careers, whereas otherwise you might have been just at the beginning. It's a different experience from having children in your early 20s, as we know some families who did. And it's not necessarily that one is right and one is wrong, but the question is, which for me is wise?
Yeah. And, you know, I think the idea of the kind of bell curve is a kind of a helpful visual metaphor, not only for how the science works, but also because, you know, technically you can conceive from puberty, right? But I think everyone, Christians would agree, that it's like it's intensely unwise for a 12 or 13 year old girl to actively seek to become pregnant and start a family. And likewise, you can technically conceive until you're into your mid-40s. I personally think that is also unwise, mostly because it's, you know, pursuing that is likely to be quite a heartbreaking process because it's almost never going to work. But I think even if you were confident you could succeed, starting biological family at 45 has increasing numbers of negative consequences. But within that, in the middle of the bell curve, there is a spectrum. And yes, it might peak biologically at 21, but it might peak emotionally at 35. And as you say, I think God has granted us, I'm tentatively suggesting God has granted us a degree of freedom of choice and said, you know, men and women are able to start families at a range of ages. There are some extreme ends where I think we would agree it's not wise, but I think most Christians are given the freedom to say, act with your God-given wisdom, what is the right time for you? And that will, as you say, will differ dramatically from couple to couple. And I think it's unhelpful for either pastors or even kind of political leaders to start to say, because they're mostly men, to say women must have, you know, must open themselves up to having children from this age, because fundamentally the costs of pregnancy are borne almost entirely by the female half of a partner. Sure, once a child is born, ideally the parents would be sharing some of the load, but you know, to say, you know, women at 21 need to be dropping out of the workplace, stopping their studies, must have already found their life partner, and then prepared to spend upwards of 5 to 8 years, you know, doing repeated rounds of pregnancy. It's an easy thing for a man in his 40s or 50s to say, isn't it? When they're not the one having to bear the consequence and the cost of that ethical framework.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight and can only come to you each week through the support of listeners like you. Your support today is so important that we want to thank you for your gift by giving you a copy of Premier Insight's brand new ebook on artificial intelligence called The Robot Race. In it, two experts in AI and robotics discuss the implications of AI technology and explore what we can learn about the human race in the light of AI's growing capabilities. You'll gain insights into how your Christian faith can inform your view of this world-changing technology and its implications on your life and the future of humanity. Again, this ebook is our thanks to you for your gift in support of this program to help equip more Christians to confidently discuss their faith as it intersects with every aspect of life. To get your copy of The Robot Race, simply go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
So it's interesting, isn't it? So I'm just, if we try to sort of map this out, on the there are several factors here. There is the individual freedom which we're given as Christians and as couples to choose wisely about fertility and all those kind of choices. And then there is the question to which we are happy to use invasive technology. So I think the comparison with IVF is very interesting, because you're right that, you know, way back several decades ago, when I was first wrestling with this question of is it ethical for Christians, particularly those who want to take a conservative theological position and biblically based position, is it ethical for Christians to use IVF? And after a certain amount of heart-searching discussion with others, reading and so on, research, I came to the conclusion that although there were all kinds of problems and challenges and difficulties and dangers in going down the IVF route, I couldn't say, no, this is wrong. This is something that is unacceptable for Christians, provided you used your own sperm and your own eggs. I did feel that there was a line between embryo or sperm or egg donation from somebody else versus using your own sperm and eggs. And I think there's an analogy there with egg freezing. So can I say from a Christian point of view, no, this is unethical, this is wrong, this is against the creation order? I find that very difficult to do. But I certainly wouldn't be recommending it to a Christian single person, woman, who was, you know, asking, would this be a wise thing to do?
I think when it comes to that particular kind of pastoral issue of, you know, a single Christian woman approaches you and says, you know, I'm currently single, I'd love to have kids one day, the blood clock is ticking, should I freeze eggs? I think there's an additional layer of complexity there, because while I'm not intrinsically opposed to single Christians, as we mentioned before, in the context of of surrogacy and adoption. I'm not necessarily opposed to single Christians starting families by themselves. I think we should still work within the framework that the kind of expectation or the normative understanding of how we form a kind of Christian family unit is with a father and a mother. And so what this single Christian woman is saying is, I'm going to freeze eggs now in the expectation that in the next, before my 10-year is like time limit is up, I will meet and marry a Christian man. And then we will then do IVF together. And that's really a decision that she can't make without this as yet unknown husband's consent and agreement. And so it's really beginning a kind of form of fertility treatment with only half of the kind of consent and discussion and reflection and prayer and wisdom required. That's, I think, something that jumps out for me as potentially problematic if you're doing it as a single person with the expectation that by the time you come to kind of use your frozen eggs, you'll be doing it as a couple. Did your future husband want to do this? Is that how they wanted to go about it? What do they feel about IVF? You know, those are some of the questions I'd want to ask.
Yeah, I suppose the counter argument is it's simply I'm keeping my options open. I'm not saying, yes, we are going to do IVF, but it's simply there on the table as an option. And it's interesting that the way that I can think of several women have framed it to me is more in a sort of negative thing. Am I being irresponsible in not freezing my eggs? Is this, you know, this option is now available to me. Yes, it's expensive. Yes, it's invasive. Yes, it has all kinds of uncertainties. But am I being irresponsible? And it is interesting, isn't it? That is a recurring theme. When it's not a technological option, you know, go back 30 years, it's not an option. Don't think about it. It's not a dilemma. Once technology provides the possibility, now I need a reason to say no.
Yeah. And I find that really insidious and unwelcome. And it reminds me of previous conversations we've had around things like, you know, new forms of testing that are now possible on kind of infants in the womb. Which can then create a whole new heap of ethical dilemmas, you know, once you now know in a way that was never possible that your child has Down syndrome when they're only 26 weeks old inside the womb, you know, what do you do about that? Well, that's a dilemma that previous generations didn't have to struggle with. I think there is this unwelcome implication from advance of new technology that once something has become as possible, the default is to utilize it, when actually Christians and all people, I think, should feel free to say, well, do you know what? I don't want to go there. It's not something I've ever been interested in. It's not something I don't feel the need to kind of formulate a good reason why I'm not freezing my eggs. The reason is the same reasons why for countless thousands of years in the past, women haven't frozen their eggs. Okay, for them, it was also impossible, but I shouldn't, just because it has now become possible doesn't mean I should have to come up with a complex, you know, well-worked, thought-through reason why I'm going to say no, thank you. But there is this increasing pressure from, you see that in the advertising and in the kind of the way it is framed in some of the kind of public conversation. Why wouldn't you freeze your eggs? Well, there are lots of reasons. It's an painful, you know, women often say it's quite unpleasant process, having these daily hormone injections to stimulate ovulation. And then it creates all these dilemmas about when you're ticking clock and it's expensive. Like, there are loads of reasons why you shouldn't have them. And I think we should push back against this idea that it becomes kind of so normalized that you need to have a good reason not to.
Yeah, that's right. And I think one of the recurring points I come to in all these discussions about ethics is that what is often underplayed is that basically what we're creating is different visions of the future here. You know, so here are two different visions of the future in this particular thing. One vision of the future is where the state and businesses and everyone else normalizes egg freezing. This is simply part of normal living.
Do it on your 21st birthday, maybe your parents came through it.
You get the best eggs, you know, have a party, you know, whatever. Everybody does it. It's normalized. And then you are free to, you know, women can participate. They can delay pairing off. They can delay having babies and so on, knowing that they've got this insurance policy. That's one vision of the future. And another vision of the future is where there's a wholesale change in social attitudes, where businesses, educational, everything changes in order to allow women to have babies at an earlier age without jeopardizing their employment prospects, their education, their future opportunities, and so on. We change the structures of society to take account of biology rather than we use technology to change biology. I mean, is that just naive, idealistic, or is that a genuine vision of a future?
I think it's both. I think it is naive and idealistic, but I think it's also the future that we should be striving to build, irrespective. I agree with you that, I don't want to live in a world, personally, where egg freezing and these more increasingly kind of extreme interventions to kind of remold biological fertility and kind of human created processes that have been laid down, since the time began and since God invented us, where I don't want to live in a world where it becomes completely accepted that we will use every technological power at our ability to supersede those and to reshape those around our own desires. But I don't want to go back to a world, the unwelcome world before fertility treatment, where women were, married off at 21 and then basically spent their peak years at home raising endless numbers of children while the man went out and exercised his economic freedom and agency to work a job and build things and create businesses. And, I don't want to lose all the gains of the feminist revolution and allowing women full access to the marketplace and to the business world. And therefore, how do you have the best of both worlds? Well, I think, as you say, it could only look like a completely remodeled kind of economic social contract where if women want to step out off the kind of career ladder in their 20s to raise children at their biological peak, that doesn't come with kind of lifelong consequences. And, the data suggests that we actually can correlate kind of lifetime earnings aren't as high for women who have children at younger ages. So this is not irrational why women are doing this in many cases. It's rational because they will suffer long-term employment financial consequences. And that is the thing that we need to be targeting and trying to think of clever policies to reshape how our business and cultural life works, rather than saying, well, we can just chuck £10,000 to the fertility clinic and dip some eggs in liquid nitrogen and bish bash bosh, we've squared that circle. That doesn't seem to be a good way to go about it. All that said, not that I therefore believe that anyone who ever freezes their eggs has done something wrong, because I can think of circumstances where it might be a wise choice.
And it's interesting, isn't it, politically, if you then take that option, it's interesting that it neither fits into the traditional left-wing paradigm or to the traditional right-wing paradigm. That's taking the best of the left-wing, saying the best of the, the opportunities, allowing and encouraging and reinforcing women as equal partners in society and in employment and in academic, whilst at the same time trying to protect the right-wing concern for families, for traditional, ways of being human.
It's almost like following the way of Jesus doesn't neatly map onto our flawed human political divides. And potentially the Christian ethics doesn't neatly fit into our existing right and left-wing boxes.
Absolutely. And for me, the sadness is that it seems so often Christian ethical discourse does divide into, these, it seems, prior political commitments then prevent us from thinking outside the box. And this is where, again, what we need is real innovation. We need employment, educational, academic innovation, which preserves the best, preserves the creation order, allows women to be genuinely have genuine options whilst exploring all the wonderful opportunities which technology offers.
And this is a bit of a side note, but this is why I am so reluctant to kind of follow some of the more kind of doom-laden warnings from some kind of Christian leaders that, you know, Western society is doomed and we need to kind of retreat in on ourselves to protect the faith and preserve ourselves as a faithful remnant. Because fundamentally, the kind of social-wide kind of cultural revolution we're talking about that would enable women to have the best of both worlds, that needs to be modeled and inspired and led by socially active churches, by Christians saying, you know, this is the kind of employment practices we want to see. And you know what? I'm a Christian business owner and I'm going to model that in my own business and hope it catches. And if we fall back in on ourselves, we have no chance of we might be able to preserve our particular ethical beliefs about created order and stuff, but we'll have no chance of being salt and light in that city on the hill that draws, that lifts the vision of our kind of lost and confused secular society and says there is a better way, there is a more inspiring way to square that circle rather than just throwing money and test tubes at the problem.
Yeah, and interestingly, there are some wonderful examples of that in previous eras of Christian business people. I'm thinking of people like the Cadburys and others who, out of their real concern to improve the lots of workers in their factories and, you know, had inspiring and innovative social innovations which came out of their Christian commitments. And, you know, wouldn't it be lovely to see Christian business owners and entrepreneurs and others pioneering not just great new businesses, but also ways of demonstrating Christian thinking in the way that they encourage women to, in some ways, have the best of both worlds. I mean, I hesitate about that terminology, but it's
probably not possible, but
it's fulfilling everything that God has given us. You know, God has given us such extraordinary potential in so many different areas of our lives. How can we fulfill them?
And what concerns me more, I think, than the particular ethics of one woman choosing to freeze her eggs is more about how egg freezing has become presented in cultures. You know, so we mentioned earlier about how it's increasingly common for some big tech companies in the States to offer egg freezing as a kind of perk, as part of your health benefits with your employment package. And this is often framed as, this is about female empowerment, and this is because we're like a feminist-led company, which I'm sure some of that is genuine and is often driven by kind of female executives. But if in truth, the reason, or part of the reasons why employers want, businesses want to offer this, is because they know that if women freeze their eggs, they're more likely not to step off the career ladder. They're more likely to stay engaged, plugged in, fully productive, hardworking employees. And so it actually benefits fundamentally the bottom line. And I think that is a disappointing response to the issue. As you say, what would be lovely would be to see businesses taking the lead and saying, here's how we're recreating our business culture and practices. Here's how we're changing our recruitment and our promotion and our HR so that women feel genuinely liberated to choose the right time for them, irrespective of what people around them are doing to have families. But they're not. They're saying, we'll just throw in egg freezing onto the health plan. That's a good way of solving that problem. And I think that's, I have almost more concerns about that and about some of the ways that the clinics market and explain the treatment. We haven't talked about often the misleading or absent statistics about success rates that are shared with women when they choose to egg freeze. I have more concerns about some of the ethics of that maybe than I do about, is the act itself problematic?
Yeah. And again, a theme that we come back to repeatedly is that technology provides an apparent technological fix for a problem which is not primarily technological. I mean, it's a problem which is, again, as we talked about before, it's biological, it's social, it's philosophical, it's spiritual, but it's spiritual.
One thing we haven't really touched on, I think kind of the last piece of the puzzle of this, is the separate question of, is it ethical for these fertility clinics to offer egg freezing when they are aware both that most women will never return to actually use their eggs, and even the ones that do, the success rates are shockingly quite low. And I think separate from the ethics of the procedure itself or how it's marketed and how it works in society, simple question of, is this kind of mis-selling to offer an expensive treatment that worth, you know, can cost upwards of £10,000 when the data that we have suggests that it probably doesn't work and most women won't come return to use it?
Yeah, and it is interesting that a number of studies have suggested that actually not only are those women who want to use their eggs may then discover that it doesn't work for some reason, that it's unsuccessful, the stored eggs don't always work, but also in one study, less than 1 in 10 of women who had frozen their eggs actually returned to use their eggs. And apparently the main reason for not using the stored eggs was that women were still single and didn't want to become a single parent. Yeah. You know, they hadn't found a partner. Yes, they've got eggs stored, but actually, you know, I don't want to become a single parent, so I'm not going to use those eggs.
Yeah, I mean, astonishingly, the most common age in the UK to freeze eggs is 38. So at that point, you know, it's one thing if you're freezing eggs at 25, intending to reimplant them at 35, because your success rates are going to be much higher. But the truth is, the vast majority of women who freeze are doing this because they have spent their 20s and 30s trying to find the right man, haven't yet, and are starting to worry, are starting to panic that it might not happen in time. And so they freeze at a time when it's still possible, but increasingly difficult. And so when you then come to thaw, you know, what many clinics often are vague about is the fact that actually some eggs just don't thaw. And so when they're unfrozen, they're completely unsuitable, unviable. And then of those eggs that you can reimplant, again, as we discussed in IVF, like, there is a vast range of reasons why it may not progress onto a successful pregnancy and a live birth. You know, in some, this very hard to find data because egg freezing is new, and obviously women often take a long time to kind of come back and return. But some of the limited studies that have been done suggest that there can sometimes only be an 18% birth rate, you know, i.e. less than 1 in 5 women who come back and manage to successfully thaw eggs and reimplant them actually manage to carry that through to a child. And so, you know, this is a slightly tongue-in-cheek comparison, and maybe it's inappropriate for the subject, but sometimes this makes me feel a little bit like cryogenics, you know, this kind of spurious pseudoscience that some companies offer, saying when you die we'll freeze your body or maybe just your brain, because in the future scientists will advance and we'll be able to unthaw you and bring you back to life and you'll live again forever. And in truth, this is a sham. These are charlatans fleecing kind of gullible, naive, elderly people. And in truth, many of them won't even be able to sustain the freezing for 30, 50, 100, 200 years, let alone the science never really becoming possible. Now, clearly, it's not the same thing, because egg freezing is a genuine, viable, scientifically valid technique, and some women do come back and thaw their eggs and successfully have children through it. But there are overlaps in that this is a company hyper intensely selling on people's anxieties and their fears and their often lack of understanding of scientific knowledge, saying freeze this, and in 10 years you'll be able to do this, when they know full well that most women won't return at all, so it's just free money. And even women that do return, many of them won't be able, through no fault of their own, to take these eggs into children. Does that seem like just fundamentally unethical business practice?
Well, again, it's desperately complex, isn't it? I mean, the argument is, look, we are just responding to women's desires. These are, you know, we didn't invent this. There is a genuine desire. And so I think it's a bit too easy to say this is just greedy scientists, you know, snake oil merchants providing sham promises. But what I do feel deeply troubled about, and this is something, again, you see with IVF, that IVF for infertile couples, often elderly couples, older couples with all kinds of medical problems, IVF seems to offer this kind of mirage, this promise that just the next cycle might just possibly be successful and I could have a child. And if IVF didn't exist, although it would be desperately painful, the couple was much more likely to accept their infertility and then possibly look at some other possibilities, adopting children or something else. Whereas because the technology exists, it actually prevents a kind of psychological coming to terms, a kind of acceptance. It prevents or delays accepting my state in life, because just possibly technology might provide a solution. So it's fascinating, isn't it, how the existence of this technology impacts on our own human emotions and concerns and longings.
And I think, in closing, there is something particular about the age we live in, this, you know, what's sometimes called a kind of second or third industrial revolution, this kind of white hot acceleration of computing power and technologies and our ability to manipulate with the very building blocks of life itself, that my generation in particular, but also, you know, people who are older like you, we have come to kind of presume or expect that there will be solutions to these problems. Mm. And I think that makes us really poorly suited to live with the difficult, grey, muddy reality of life, which all human beings have had to exist with since the fall, that, you know, things are imperfect and they don't always work the way they should. And I think part of Christian maturity is holding that tension between saying, you know, this is how the world is and I have to learn to live with it, while not letting go of the hope and the expectation and the nagging question that says, but it shouldn't be like this. You know, we don't want to become kind of stoical nihilists who just say everything is always rubbish and always will be. We want to hold on to the hope that God is going to make things better, and that it is terrible. It's terrible that people are infertile and can't have children. It's terrible that people long for children but haven't yet found the right partner or, you know, the right man to have those children with. But I think we have to learn as human beings, as created beings, to let go and to acknowledge and accept some of our limitations and our finitude, as we said in many podcasts before. And I think our technological era that has produced things like egg freezing and various other treatments makes it harder and harder for Christians to develop that discipline and that virtue of kind of you know, what Paul would say, a kind of contentment in all circumstances, even in difficult times, a contentment and a trust and a reliance that ultimately everything is going to be okay because there is a sovereign creator.
Wise words, Tim. Yep. Desire and contentment. It's having our desires rightly ordered. That's a sort of Augustine's framework. And increasingly I see the wonderful wisdom of that. Yes, desires are God-given, but they should be rightly ordered according to the creation order that God has given.
Hmm. Well, let's end it there. We've talked for a long time on this. We'd be really interested in any of your thoughts. If you've been listening to this and you're considering freezing your eggs, or you have frozen your eggs, we'd love to hear your experience and your perspective on this. As we said, we're not claiming to be offering any kind of definitive answers. We're just kind of exploring some of the ethical questions that arise. But yeah, please do get in touch. You can email molad@premier.org.uk. You can find me on Twitter @TSWyatt. But on anything else as well, if you found an interesting new development, a new story or a sign of element that you'd like us to respond to, please do send those in. And any other questions or suggestions you might have, we're really interested in your feedback. And there's lots more resources, as always, on lots of medical ethics issues, like the ones we've been discussing, on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. Go in there. There's lots of videos and talks and things to read, links to all his books. And we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.